This week's throne speech was probably the most vacuous I've ever read. What are your thoughts?
Well, I didn't have to read it. I had to listen to it, Ian. That was even more difficult to do. Your analysis of the intent, the political and sociological intent of throne speeches is correct. The governments in all jurisdictions, in all parliaments, lay out their plan for the coming year or the coming session. We prorogue every year in British Columbia. Many parliaments, the House of Commons, for example, rarely prorogues. They have a throne speech, and then they may have another throne speech halfway through the term. We do it every year. In fact, we've had three throne speeches in the past 12 months. We had one last February, was all about LNG. We had one last October, which was all about LNG. And then we had one 2 days ago that mentioned LNG in passing. So that speaks to the swift change in the views of the government. They want to now focus on other things. And instead of focusing on what they're going to do in a forward-looking way, they went back and recited statistics from days gone by that were supposed to give people the impression that things were all well. And of course, they're not all well. I talked to people in my travels around the province now as leader of the opposition. I talked to people back home in Langford and Souk, and they're getting nickeled and dimed to death. Fees and licenses continue to go up. Services continue to go down. It's paycheck to paycheck for too many families in a province that has so much potential. Our natural resources, our human capital, our institutions of higher learning, our K-12 system. We have tremendous potential, but I believe it's being squandered by a government that had spent the past 3 years talking about an industry that just isn't going to get off the ground anytime soon, and we're all paying the price for that.
John, when you travel around the province, do you find that people in the rural parts of British Columbia have different issues than people in urban parts of British Columbia?
Very much so. And I think that, I mean, I'm a born and raised Islander, and I represent an area now that that stretches from what's becoming a very dynamic urban area in Langford, with rural and suburban areas leading out towards Souk, and then very rural out towards Port Renfrew. But you imagine the whole province is made up of urban density, suburban areas, rural communities, and everyone's issues are different. And it's been very revealing for me as not just as a politician, but as a person, the diversity of needs as you crisscross the province. What's required in the Northwest is different from the Northeast. The Kootenays is not Kamloops, and Prince George is not northern British Columbia, it's central British Columbia. So these issues are apparent to anyone who's taken a geography course. It's different when you talk to the people, and their needs are distinct, and I believe that if my political party is going to be successful in the coming election, we have to talk to voters in rural communities that have walked away from us over the past 20 years. I think that's demonstrable by results at election after election. If people in Kamloops and Williams Lake and Prince George are going to look to me as the leader of the province, I have to speak to issues that are relevant to them. And I'm doing my level best to understand them and then articulate them in the legislature. That seems to be working well. I'm getting a positive reception. Every time I return to a rural community, people say, I remember that guy, you were here and you said something that made sense to me. So I'm going to keep trying to do that.
What do rural British Columbians, what are their issues that we may not recognize here in an urban area?
Well,
go ahead.
Firstly, the resource economy, which was vital to Souk 25 years ago, less vital to Souk today, although we continue to see truck after truck leaving the Jordan River tree farm license area and the forest lands west of Souk. But those logs are no longer going to mills to produce jobs on Vancouver Island. They're going to Tidewater to go to mills offshore. And that transition in the rural resource economy on southern Vancouver Island has been replaced by other activities, tourism, service development. Government employment is relatively high, obviously, in the capital region. So the transition for Souk and points west to the new economy has been happening over 25 years. But the communities of Quesnel, there are three or four vibrant mills there now making paper, making plywood, making dimensional lumber. So the issues in Quesnel are not the issues in Highlands. And you need to be able to address those as they emerge. I know that for many people who are detached from that rural lifestyle, that resource lifestyle, when we talk about mining, people think immediately of Mount Polley and the disaster there, the results of deregulation over the past 15 years. But the mining sector has a modest footprint when you consider the clear cuts that have bespotted the lands in my constituency of Juan de Fuca. The good news about clear cuts is that the trees grow back. The mining sector leaves a mark. It's a small mark, but it's a significant one. And if you live in those communities and you're benefiting from the development of those resources, you're okay with that. And I also find the people that live in rural communities are more attached to their environment than we here in Lankford and Highlands and Metchosin, because they're living it every day.
Now, the provincial budget comes down next week, and in the BC Liberals' election platform of the last election, there was a promise to reduce the increase in the personal income tax rate for those earning in excess of $150,000 by January of 2016. So they'll get rid of that that income tax rate. What impact will that have on the provincial budget?
$236 million by our calculation. That's a $236 million tax cut for the top 2% wage earners in British Columbia. I'm thinking, Ian, and I'm fairly confident the vast majority, probably about 98% of your listening audience, is going to say that's outrageous. At a time when we are seeing increases in fees, MSP premiums, hydro rates, ICBC rates, ferry fares for we on the island here, to suggest that there's $236 million lying around to give to those who make over $150,000 in salary makes people quite uncomfortable. An issue that I raised in the legislature just today, and I understand you were talking about TransLink before I came on. I was in the House, so I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we were.
We've got two CEOs at $500,000 a year now. They fired one, but they didn't really fire him. They're keeping him on to advise the new CEO. Now, again, the common sense quotient in most of your listeners would be, if his advice was not valuable on Monday and Tuesday of this week, why are we continuing to pay him to give advice to the new guy on Thursday and Friday? And the government's response was, it's complicated. Well, it's not complicated when you're living paycheck to paycheck and you're not seeing anything coming your way other than increases, and you hear about double CEOs at a dysfunctional transit system in Vancouver and $236 million to the richest people in BC. These are, you know, you can't write this stuff, Ian. I tell you, this is not about class politics. It's about common sense. It's about making sure that those who are making a large sums of money are giving a fair portion of that back. The MSP tax that many of us pay is a regressive tax because Jimmy Pattison pays the same as you and I. And that's just not right. And at the same time we're grappling with that inconsistency and injustice, we see a massive amount of money being given back to people who really don't need it.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Gary. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi. And it's not only that there's two CEOs right now, but the one that just got hired, his wage is $35,000 a month, and that's just absurd. And they're nitpicking people that aren't paying their fares, and, you know, $35,000 a month? Like, that's just unbelievable.
Yeah, it's hard.
He won the lottery.
It's hard to imagine, isn't it? And yet the government today, of course, the premier wasn't there. Big surprise. We're 2 days in, and all of a sudden there's no premier. But I guess we'll have to get used to that. I spent the fall waiting for her to show up. I felt like I was standing on the porch, looking out into the distance, longingly for the leader of the government to come and defend policies. Well, she was nowhere to be found today.
Yeah, well, it's just weird that TransLink fails on an epic scale almost every week, and, like, who deserves $35,000 a month? I'd like to know what he does for that.
Well, we'll never find out. We'll never find out, because Amrik Virk, the now minister responsible for freedom of information, just introduced a new act today that will help streamline document disposal. In other words, we'll show you the delete button on your computer so you can get rid of all this stuff. There will not be a record of what he does. He won't have to report. He will have no performance measurements. He will just have $35,000 a month.
Yeah, well, thanks for commenting on that, and go out and expose all these losers.
I'll do my best.
Thanks. What was that? He's going to streamline document disposal?
No. I'm putting two stories together. There was the bill table today by Amrik Virk, the fellow who apparently did nothing wrong, and there was going to be no cabinet shuffle, and then the last week of December, all of a sudden, Amrik Virk was removed from his conflicted role as advanced education minister. This is insider stuff, Ian, but he's now responsible for freedom of information, and ironically, it was emails that he claimed he didn't remember exposed his incompetence on a file, and now he's responsible for FOI, and the first thing he does is streamlining document disposal, which is just, the irony was not lost on my colleague David Eby, who who laughed probably more than he should have when the bill was introduced. You're not supposed to do that, but it was pretty funny.
We had a chat with Lindsay Meredith, the marketing professor at SFU, about TransLink, and I was mentioning, and these are from Norm Farrell's figures, and Norm, as you know, is an excellent researcher, former accountant, and he determined, he found the information from 2013 that the chair of TransLink, Nancy Olweiler, was given a $100,000 retainer to be chair on top of her $152,000 salary at SFU. All the other chairs of directors of the TransLink were given retainers of $30,000, including meeting fees. So they're all given...
And expenses.
Yeah. So it was well over $50,000. And 1,450 people at Transit, more than 20% of the staff, make over $80,000 a year. And the bonuses, the average bonus for seven senior executives at TransLink in 2013 was over $32,000. Now, this is for an organization that is failing. And as a listener sent me an email during our discussion with Lindsay, why are we rewarding people who fail?
That's a sentiment I hear wherever I go. And TransLink is particularly galling for those in the Lower Mainland. They have an additional gas tax. You'll know if you travel to the Lower Mainland, the gas prices are higher there than they are here on the South Island. We have a gas tax that goes towards our transit as well, but it's smaller. I think it's a 2.5 cents or 3 cents. In the Lower Mainland, it's double that. And now we're having a referendum there, a plebiscite, that's calling on an increase in 0.5% for the provincial sales tax within the Metro Vancouver area, which is going to be a very complicated to administer. Small businesses are going to have to change all of their registers, those in the retail sector. It's going to be a reporting nightmare. The government is lukewarm to it, even having said you must have a referendum. They're the ones that are going to be administering it, but it is going to be a disaster. And it's not that people don't want to invest in improvements in transportation. In the Lower Mainland, I mean, we complain, and I mean, I have been championing increasing transit and transportation improvements on the South Island since the day I was elected, because that's what my constituents demand. The Saanich stall, the Colwood crawl, whatever you want to call it, I've been talking about that for 9 years. But when you go to the Lower Mainland, it's shocking. The extent of the congestion, the consequences to families is obvious, but it's also a negative impact on the economy. And for the government to waste 2 years of this mandate pretending to be addressing the issues, today, this week's solution is to have a second CEO. Two heads are better than one. My mom told me that, but she didn't tell me to pay $1 million for those two heads. And now the public are going to be asked to say, give them more money. And I think that we're supporting the referendum. I believe that we need to make the investments, but it's going to be a hard sell, I tell you, when they keep doing stupid things like this.
I'm sure I have an email here from John Pierre. I'm sure you've heard this before. That Horgan guy talks way too much. Tell him the NDP lost the last election and will probably lose the next one. Too much whining.
Yeah, well, I'm just speaking what I hear there, John, and take a look at the internet and find out what British parliamentary democracy is about. There's a government and there's an opposition. I'm shining light on the shortcomings of the government. If you prefer to let them just waste your money and have nobody talk about it, then maybe go to the United States, because they don't do anything there.
John Horgan is our guest, NDP leader, leader of the opposition. We welcome your calls. We'll take a break and come back.
Engaging talk. It's the Ian Jessup Show.
Welcome back. We're talking to John Horgan, leader of the NDP in British Columbia. And, John, we have an email here from John who says, would you please ask your guests as to whether he will make public the number of times the premier attends the legislature? Thank you.
Yeah, we're going to keep, but we kept track last fall. She was there 7 of 24 days, and I missed one day. And the premier got up and made reference to it, which you're not allowed to do. I mean, that's why I'm happy to talk on the radio about it. But the rules of the parliament suggest that you're not supposed to make reference to those who are not there. And I had an opportunity today in exchange with the transportation minister, who said, does the NDP support X or Y? And I on this referendum question in the Lower Mainland. And I said, I come from Wandafuca. I can't vote in the transit referendum, but the member for Kelowna Westside, who lives in Vancouver, said she's going to vote for it. She's not here today, and I could have got into trouble for that, but because I talk quickly, I think they just let it go. But we are going to keep track, and we're going to post it on our webpage of premier sightings whenever we see her. She was here for the throne speech, and she was here yesterday for question period. So she's 2 out of 3 this week. That's not too bad. I don't know if you can get away with that at most workplaces, but... Okay. It was a good song, 2 out of 3. What's that? Meatloaf, wasn't it?
I'll let you go on that one. Yeah. Let's go to the next caller, Don. Hi, Don.
Yeah, good afternoon, Ian, and to you, John. I was wondering, John, if you could comment on a couple of things. The first idea is, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what it means for the province to receive new money by exports. You know, one idea would be the shipping of raw logs. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it just strikes me as, you know, stupidity to the max. I mean, you're shipping off new money coming in, so to speak, in the worst form. The other...
Don, if I can just interrupt, I have in front of me here, Norm Farrell did an analysis that when the NDP were in power from 1991 to 2001, the average monthly log exports in cubic meters were under 100,000 cubic meters. Today... the Liberals in 2010 to 2014, the average monthly log exports are over 450,000 meters.
Mm-hmm.
Those are raw logs. Yeah.
500% increase. It just for those to simplify the cubic meters, there's been a 500% increase on the Liberal watch of raw log exports.
I would even go a step further and talk a bit about how much money that we lost out on.
Well, you know what? Sorry to interrupt, but and I don't want to break up your questioning, but Norm Farrell could do the analysis because he would go back and do the research on what the net present value of the dollar was versus the U.S. dollar. I mean, it's a complicated number to come to, but there are people out there that can do it, and Norm Farrell's doing it in his spare time. The government does it every day and then withholds the information from the public. They can quantify to the penny how much we're losing from these exports, but they don't make it public because it'll make them look really bad, and it'll highlight the 25,000 fewer people working in the forest sector today than there were in 2001. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay, John. I appreciate your passion, but I just look at it, you know, maybe from a layperson's point of view, and you know, we're kind of stupid, aren't we, as far as British Columbians?
Speak for yourself.
No, but they allow this to happen. It's absolutely correct.
Absolutely, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. But the other question I had for you, John, was the idea of, I think we've lost the sense of value for services rendered and goods made. A lot of corporations they have this equation now where it's not what it costs them, it's what they can charge for it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's a different business equation that I think it is, what would you say? It can't go on forever. You have to have people making, like, the new money has to come into the province. It's trickled down throughout, and then taxes, you know, are derived from that. But when we have a situation where we just tax and tax again, and we have so many people that, what would you say? They aren't earning their keep. They aren't worth their salt, but they have the ability to increase their income. And it's almost like a disease. And I think really that needs to be changed personally, whether it's NDP, whether it's Liberal, or whether it's Green. But it's kind of like the business model. So I was wondering if you could comment on that, John.
Yeah, well, you've got a lot to chew on there, and I'll come back to the logs because it's a graphic example, particularly for those of us on Vancouver Island. The coastal forest sector is where most of the raw logs are coming from as well. I mean, if you do a percentage of coastal forest, so the larger trees, the interior forests are smaller, pine mostly, not the big firs and spruce and hemlock that we would have, and cedar that we have on the coast. So when you start looking at the jobs that are lost, that's money that you're paying for a skill to add value to a piece to a standing tree. Every time you touch that tree and you pay someone to make it better and make the product more valuable to the end purchaser, you're circulating new dollars into the economy. So when you cut that tree down with a feller buncher, you got a guy driving a feller buncher, you drop it on the back of a truck, you got a man or woman driving the truck, they take it to Tidewater, you got someone to take it off the truck and put it on a barge or put it on a boom, that's it. We're done. In the old days, we would take that tree, we would cut it into dimensional lumber, we would take the byproduct, and we would make pulp out of it. We would take the pulp, make paper, and on and on and on it goes. We're not doing that anymore. And our pulp sector, even though the price drop is a significant issue, but getting access to chips, because there are no more sawmills. You don't have a sawmill, you're not making chips. And if you don't have chips, you can't make pulp. And on it goes. So every time we just send a log offshore, it's money that we're giving to somebody else. And everybody with an ounce of common sense can see that. I don't want to take the jobs from the feller buncher operator or the truck driver or the boom operator, but that's a fraction of what we used to do with a log. And they're getting more jobs per cubic meter in Ontario and Quebec than they are in British Columbia. And when we were the dominant player in North America in forestry for 100 years, it's pathetic that we've got to the place we are now.
Don, got to go. I appreciate it. I'm out of time.
Take care.
Thank you very much. John, we'll let you go. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.